Want to expand the influence of design? Pragmatic Institute offers interactive, actionable courses for designers who are looking to contribute more strategically in their organizations. Explore our offerings such as Business Strategy and Design and Influence Through Storytelling at pragmaticinstitute.com/design.
And welcome to Design Chats, a podcast from Pragmatic Institute, where we sit down with design leaders, practitioners, and alumni to discuss how to grow the strategic impact of design. I am Rebecca Calajeris, Vice President of Product Strategy at Pragmatic Institute. And today we are extremely excited to have with us Eddie Isaac. He's a Managing Director of UX and Product Design at JP Morgan, and someone who is both very passionate about design and very thoughtful about how designers and design practices can kind of continue to elevate their impact within organizations. So we are extremely excited to have you here, Eddie. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here with you.
All right. First, just to give everyone listening a little bit more context about you and a little bit understanding, tell me about your path into design and why you are so passionate about what you do.
Sure. So my path in design really started out when I was a kid. I mean, as a kid, I remember really loving to sketch. I was a doodler. So I loved the arts. I would sketch my family members, famous people. I loved sketching my favorite cartoon characters. And I also had this really interest, like keen interest in how things worked. I actually remember getting a book, I think maybe for my birthday. It was called How Things Work. So this like combination of like arts and engineering was there in my youth. For quite a while, I entered science fairs and math fairs and invention fairs as a kid. I was always interested in creating things. And there was actually one specific math fair I do remember entering. I got second place. But it was this math fair where I had to try to find the volume. We had to make up a math problem. Okay, so the problem I made up was how many bricks or blocks of granite did it take to build the giant Khufu pyramid in Egypt? And you know, my parents were Egyptian. They had immigrated in the late 70s. So naturally, I'd already been to the pyramids a couple of times at this point. So, you know, it's interest in using geometry, figuring out how many big granite stones it takes to build the pyramid. You had to figure out the volume of the pyramid. You had to kind of hollow out the king's chambers and all the pharaoh's rooms, that kind of thing. And I had to build this really, what I thought was a beautiful model of the pyramid. I got second place. Why? I got points marked off because my palm trees were not to scale. And I was kind of annoyed, not because like my math wasn't wrong. It's just that my palm trees were, if they were to scale, that you wouldn't see them. Like they were going to be so tiny, so minuscule, you couldn't see it. So it was almost like form over function. It's like design, like aesthetics versus like functionality was already, you know, at play in my youth. And it cost me first place in this math fair. But I ended up studying computer science in college at University of California in San Diego. And my last year, I took a graphics course. I loved this graphics course. I was spending hours creating things that I didn't need to, going above and beyond what was expected of the course. And by the time I was done, I wasn't ready for grad school. I knew I wanted to go to grad school, but I wasn't quite ready with the GREs and applications. So I spent a year at Microsoft. And I was building software for internal product managers, technologists to test Hotmail and MSN Calendar APIs. And I spent probably 90% of the time building a usable piece of software more than the actual function of the testing. So I built this user interface, this GUI on top of the API test, which no one was expecting. They're all expecting some command line interface. But I spent all this time making this thing usable and it got such great feedback on just the usability of the tool and the aesthetics, of course, that they ended up using it quite often every single day, more than the predecessor of the tool. I then knew that like that's where I wanted to go. I wanted to do usability way more than engineering. I left Microsoft the next year, got my PhD at Columbia University in the computer graphics and user interfaces lab there. I was mainly doing some augmented reality and virtual reality systems there, but my thesis was focused on more traditional like interaction techniques. So I was studying HCI, human-computer interaction. I was building the things. I was designing the things. I was inventing new solutions for problems that existed both now and what we thought problems would be in the future. Of course, that's kind of what you do in academia. And so I realized very, very quickly, like my career was not going to be in development. It was going to be in UI design and problem solving and building good experiences with technology.
I love that story. I can feel both the frustration about the second place and the palm trees, but also like how it led to, I think one of the things I think you did really smart is like, you let your career path be developed by where you got so excited. And I think that's why so many people go into design. It wasn't, they were like sitting down with a spreadsheet, like, well, this will be the career that gets me to the right place, that gets me the right money. It's because it's where they sparkle, right? It's like where you get like the little butterflies in your stomach because this is what you want to do. And this is like the kind of impact you want to make. So I think that's a great story of how you got where you are and a clear demonstration of how passionate you are. One of the other things that I know is true in your history that we didn't touch upon quite as much there was, right, is sort of that there's a really strong leadership vein that runs through your career history. And it's something, again, like design, that you're very passionate about.
Yeah. And, you know, there's many facets to leadership. When I think about like leadership, sometimes we think about being, you know, managers or people managers traditionally, right? You have an org under you and people reporting to you. Really, a manager is just someone who's been given a responsibility of something. You could be a manager of people. Great. So you're responsible for people and their well-being and their growth, et cetera. But you can manage projects, right? You can manage processes. You can manage finances. You can manage a whole program of work. In the end, you're just caring for that thing. You may be advancing it, maybe trying to bring it to maturity. You're just responsible for a resource. Leadership, on the other hand, I've grown to learn that all it requires for you to be a leader is someone to follow you. It doesn't require management of anything. So if someone's following you, you're leading in some way. It also means there's a direction of travel. So you're going in a particular direction, which means you probably have a strategy for something, right? And you can lead in a variety of ways, right? You can lead people. You can certainly lead projects. You can lead those who report to you. You can lead your peers. You can lead people across the firm. No matter what domain you're in or what position you have, you know, good leadership really comes down to one thing. Do people want to follow you? You can't force people to follow you. So if no one's following, you're not a leader. And we can talk about the traits of what makes a good leader, right? Are they a positive person? Are they an empathetic person? Are they transparent and open? Are they trustworthy? Yes, all of those things. So they have high emotional intelligence? Yes. And those are all potentially desirable characteristics, but none of it matters if no one wants to follow you or if you're not leading something that people care about, where they want to join your direction, the direction that you are traveling. So think about people who assume that, you know, these senior executives, these are the people who lead, right? It's only those with two decades of experience and hundreds of people under them that can lead. No, it's possible for a junior associate straight out of college to lead. Absolutely, that person can lead. Find a domain that you are passionate about, that you know you can deliver impactful results in, and you have a potential to lead. You just have to create that environment, make sure you get the support, and start that initiative where people are yearning for your leadership to lead there.
I love that too. I mean, I think it's very empowering and very true when we think of our listeners that like this isn't someone who's going to give you the mantle of leadership. Now you are a leader, move on, right? It's something that you can sort of grab. It is something that you can build organically. And the other thing, the point that I think you made that was really interesting is about where you can lead, right? You're not just leading people. You can lead projects. You can lead initiatives. You can lead sort of cultural changes. There are so many ways that you can lead.
Yeah, I can give you a couple examples here at JP Morgan, for example. We currently have a hybrid model, right? So we work in the office, but some work at home part of the week. And so it makes it interesting in terms of the culture, right? Because pre-COVID, everyone was in the office. So, and we grew quite a bit over COVID. So we had this unique challenge of like new faces, different people in the office, different days. There's an in-office culture that kind of needed to be re-energized. So it started with me when I joined, this is right after Omicron. So this is like late 2021, early 2022. And we had to get people to kind of want to come back into the office, right? Yeah. And so it just started with me buying lunch for people once a week, just sponsor a lunch, get people to talk outside of work. Okay, that's the least I could do. And people got addicted to this, right? They're like, oh, human to human interaction again, right? And I didn't even have to ask. I mean, it took literally days or maybe a couple of weeks at most for people to riff off that gesture of a lunch, to go and organize a visit to the local museum, to go and organize a game night after work, to start a flower growing contest. Yes, a flower growing contest. My flower is doing quite well, actually.
And excellent.
It's sitting in the window. A lot of these kind of culture growth kind of things were happening through the leadership of individual contributors. And then that group started to grow and grow and grow. And it's now a dozen people that want to take charge and know that there is impact as a result of their efforts. So that's classic leadership. And I'm following them, right? It's not them following me. I'm not the leader here. They're the leader and I'm following their leadership. Another example I can give is before JP Morgan, I was at Bloomberg. I was leading the UX team there at Bloomberg, and it was a very flat organization. So you tend to have like large teams, which meant you didn't have a lot of leaders. You had a lot of individuals. And just by the mere fact that we ran very lean, there was a lot of need for that horizontal leadership, meaning there are things that, you know, a team of people weren't responsible for, but a single person was responsible for the entire org. For example, the tooling that the designers use, the software and the hardware on their desks. We had a single person who led the effort to try to understand what designers needed and applied it across the org for people above, below, and their peers within the org. And again, an individual contributor who was passionate about it made everyone better and people followed that person's lead. So as long as they can identify a strategy, a direction of travel, and, you know, try to achieve a certain desired outcome that's agreed upon, they created and organized committees and other designers were starting to contribute to that effort. It was true leadership.
Well, and I think it's something to remember too, that when you're thinking about, I want a leadership role or I want design to have a bigger leadership role, it doesn't have to be the narrow thought of, I want the practice of design to be thought of that way, which 100% I'm in, right? But there's all other ways for you as an individual and for design as a part of an organization to show leadership and to show sort of leadership across all kinds of things and leadership in the things we're most passionate about, in sort of that human-centered thinking and leaning that we can demonstrate in all kinds of ways.
Absolutely.
All right. So one of the things you talk about as being really important as a leader is the ability to connect design to the language of the business. So let's talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So to understand this fully was actually quite a journey for me, right? It took me probably close to a decade to truly grasp like the importance of, well, so first of all, we all have empathy, right? We all have empathy for the end user. It's kind of design 101. So a designer straight out of school knows, understand the user, right? But really, to connect design to the business, we got to understand much more than the user. We have to understand our stakeholders as well. And people really lose sight of that. They don't understand the value of that early on in their career. It took me a while too. I studied computer science and I began my career as a software engineer, right? So my empathy for the technologist was already built in. I didn't need to grow into that. You know, while at Bloomberg, I spent 7 years designing and advancing the Bloomberg UI toolkit. So that was the technology used by, you know, thousands of Bloomberg developers. So my end user was the software developer, so the engineer, right? And of course, it was the engineers building the toolkit for their engineering peers. But when working with that product manager, right, that product manager to design, let's say, a chart application or a complex financial application, well, that's where I think kind of utopian aspirations for design perfection get in the way of the success of dealing with someone who they don't understand. So what's even more interesting is I think designers, like they're acutely aware of their domain knowledge, their lack of domain knowledge, I should say. And they even sometimes take pride in distancing themselves away from the domain. They want to abstract themselves and be pure interaction designers. And they think that actually makes them a better designer to abstract themselves away from the specifics of the domain. I think this is a major misconception and a huge, hugely lost opportunity, in my opinion, for two reasons. First of all, we can't claim to be user-centric, but then not empathize with the product owners, okay? To truly partner with them. And by the way, you notice I didn't say serve them or I said partner with them, right? Mm-hmm. We'll get to that in a second. But to truly partner with them, we have to understand their motivations, the product manager's motivations, the product manager's metrics for success. Mm-hmm. Why do they wake up in the morning every day and come to work? We do this empathy thing for the end user. We've got to do it for them too. So the second reason I'll mention now, partnership. I use the word partner very intentionally because often I hear designers say they serve their clients, or they work for their stakeholders, or they work for the product manager. Sure, they may report to a product owner, but they're supposed to be partnering. They're not designing, they're not serving anybody. The only person they're serving is the user, right? The end user. And I don't mean to make it sound like designers are above anyone else. Design, if it takes an approach of providing a service, then we're always going to have the customer is always right mentality. And if your customer is the product owner, that's a problem because they're not always right.
Right.
And ideally, design needs to have a first-class seat at the table with their product and technology counterparts and provide the proper checks and balances. And it's really challenging to be a contributing member of a product team without understanding the domain, mm-hmm. without understanding the specific business. How does the business make money? If business strategy is necessary in order to set priorities, including investments into design, then design needs to be part of that business strategy, or they're going to be brought in way too late. So I'll add that the better you understand the domain, actually, the more effective your customer research sessions will be, right? I mean, you go into deep, specific workflows without fear of not understanding someone when you're doing customer research. And additionally, it might give your sales force, you probably have to go through sales to get to the customer, most likely. It gives them confidence that your interaction with customers will be productive and relevant and not just this superficial design fluffy conversation, right? That's a kind of a common fear I hear when we go to sales and ask for outreach to customers. And especially at firms like a B2B firm, the customer is a paying customer, right? Mm. So this real like deep, strong relationship between the customer and like the sales force. And if you lose that customer, it's much more detrimental than losing, you know, a B2C customer. So we often find it's much harder to gain access to these customers because sales is quite protective of them, rightfully so. So again, having that deeper domain knowledge, connecting design to business, just makes everyone so much more comfortable with UX leading the conversation in a room with a customer and extracting those insights that really only someone trained in behavioral science and who understands the domain, that unique crossover, that's the designer, can do so effectively that no salesperson, no product person can do.
When I think you touched on a lot of things there, right? I mean, I think the idea that we are and shouldn't be subservient to anyone, but that we should be seen as partners. And part of being seen as a partner is to not sort of run away from the business side or think of ourselves as different or apart from it, but to embrace and understand the business needs so that they see that you're aligned, but also so that you can communicate back to them. When you get your findings, not only can you present the findings, but you can present it in a manner that will resonate with them, right? It's what the user wants, but it also then is presented in a way that talks about how it will affect what matters to our internal stakeholders and clients as well.
Yeah, it's really important to use the language of the business to relay the impact of your design work, right? I mean, if we say design is going to be more enjoyable, what does that mean? I mean, enjoyability could lead to more, you know, could more profitability, and you have to basically account for that and try to measure that. And that's what they want to hear. I mean, product managers want to hear P&L. Technologists want to hear uptime, right? They want to hear 99.999% uptime. That's their goal, robustness, efficiency, performance. We have to use their language and translate what we believe is good design impact to what is good business impact or positive technology impact.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, it's not utopian, right? We're not in a utopian world. We have to realize that there is a reality of like the specific org that we're in.
And the org needs to make money, right? Like that is a reality that we have to embrace, right?
And sometimes the org is like organized in a way that's not ideal for design. So we have to work within those constraints. How mature the UX business really is in your firm, how mature the business is in terms of their understanding of UX processes, how much access you have to customers. So the maturity of the design team is probably the largest factor, right? You need to have a mature design team to get a lot of this stuff done. But just almost as important is the design culture maturity. Mm. Is business being forced to use you? Or are product managers like clamoring, like grassroots movement, they're clamoring for more designers? Like they're both equally good and bad in different ways. But also something to think about are those product managers, sometimes they're former users. That's a dangerous one. If when they're a former user, they're now not just an expert in the business, but they know what the user wants. Mm. And a former user tends to be more biased towards their own experiences than the customer research that you're going to do. Even more reason why you need to understand the business so you can have that challenging conversation with that former user who's now a product owner. Now, we know they're wearing a different hat now, so they can't be a user if they're a product owner. But a professional product manager will allow a designer to go through a design process and yield those customer insights. On that note, does the designer have access to customers? We just spoke about one of the obstacles, right? The lack of domain knowledge. But does product and sales trust design to be in the same room to drive that conversation? Do they need to babysit every single conversation? That can be a limiting factor to get access to customers. Are there metrics in place? How can we possibly go visit a customer if we have no idea who or what they're doing before we go visit them? So ideally, you want to have some understanding of their behavior before you go in and try to find out why they're behaving that way, right? The whole reason of doing the qualitative side is the why and a little bit of the how. But the what, you should kind of already know what they're doing by good metrics. So if you don't have that, it makes it really, really hard to have that initial, not impossible, but to have that initial conversation. And then another thing I think that affects, you know, a reality of real organizational management is where do you sit? Literally, where do you sit geographically? Are you sitting on a floor with only designers? It might sound like a lot of fun. You probably will have more fun, but you're not going to eavesdrop on the product and tech conversations that are happening on the floor above you. And they might start to proceed on initiatives without you. So I'm a real fan of groups of designers, not individuals. You got to send them out and, you know, strengthen numbers, so to speak, of groups of designers sitting with their product and technology counterparts, being co-located with them. So design maturity, product owner background, domain knowledge, metrics, office setup, these are all factors that potentially have a large factor on doing good design work.
And I think one of the things you talk about too is like all of those things matter, but you do sort of have to pick your battles, right? Mm-hmm. Or put your energy and negotiate for the most critical items. Because it can be like, well, all of these things aren't ideal. It's like, well, let's fight for a change. Let it demonstrate that it has an impact. And then we can fight for the second set of changes, right? Kind of getting permission. One of the other things in your background, which I think is super interesting, which I don't speak to a lot of designers who have, though there are definitely some, is that your experience as sort of a technologist, right? Your experience in computer engineering, I think it is a little bit unique. And I think it gives you a really strong, informed perspective, specifically about what it is to be a good partner for the technology groups. And I think that that's sometimes an area where designers struggle, in addition to the product one, for sure. So I think giving us a little bit of your perspective on that and like, what is an ideal relationship with technology look like? And what are designers responsible for? And what do you think technologists need to be responsible for?
Really good question. This is a very, very important part of, I think, the way we do design is understanding the technology that we're using. I think a lot of designers don't have enough understanding of the technology. The irony is that in my design career, when I started, I always felt that my expertise in computer science was actually a limiting factor, not a advantageous characteristic. And the reason why is because I was always told that technologists were rigid, they needed specific criteria, needed to be deterministic. You know, there's no thinking outside the box. It's like you have constraints and you deal with those constraints, right? But coming up with novel and unique solutions and being innovative, those are design things. Those are not, you know, computer science things. We have to have a mix of the two. We have to be able to understand what the constraints are, but also be able to know how far we can push the boundaries. And when a technologist is asked to assess, you know, how viable a solution is or how scalable something is, how reusable it is, that's something that's in their wheelhouse, okay? They're not necessarily asked to push the boundary or push the envelope a little bit. So let's just take a step back here. I want to take a step back, Rebecca, and think about the different roles and motivations within a product development team. So it includes product, technology, and design, right? We've been consuming technology for the better part of 50 years, right? Apple's and Microsoft in the late 70s, early 80s. It was engineers. Engineers were writing code, developing software. You didn't have a designer in the room. You may not have even had a product manager in the room. If they were, they were probably engineering minded, right? So engineers were building, designing, and managing the product all the way through. Now, fast forward a few decades, the need for a proper product manager. There probably was a UI designer, a visual designer, maybe producing assets, but you still didn't have like good UX processes. So you had someone setting priorities, worried about P&L, that's the product manager, identifying product or market opportunities. But these were the things that like an average engineering team wasn't well equipped to do, including some of the design activities that were needed. So fast forward another decade or so post, you know, dot-com era, and we start to see the real presence of design as a core member of the serious, you know, product development team. And why the need for a designer beyond just the UI design? Well, that's obvious to us as the design community. A product needs to be viable, robust. Okay, that's engineering responsibilities. Desirable, profitable, out to market quickly. Okay, that's the product. Okay, what about who's looking out for the user, right? Who is worried about those now very complex connected workflows? They weren't so complex 50 years ago, but now you've got app connected to app and you've got these niche domains like finance and medicine and education. They all need their software to be usable too. It's not just like email. So they need their bespoke usable software built for their very unique users. And who the heck knows how they use a computer? Like, it's very, very tacit information, not very publicly understood, right? So we need this now, this field of behavioral science crossed with design to uncover this information using research, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so now we have the three-legged stool. I know there's a lot of background, but we've achieved UX utopia.
Yes.
The technologist, the product owner, the designer, they have their own motivations. They're checking and balancing each other. Okay, why all that background? Well, we wake up each morning worrying about different things. Okay, These motivations, not just sometimes, but often by design, create tension, healthy tension, the checks and balances needed to make sure the delivered product has that perfect balance of viability, desirability, and usability. And just like a designer needs to demonstrate empathy for the business, they also need to understand the technologist. How does the technology work? The specific UI and front-end technology, not just how generally how technology works. And I would say the role goes even further. Like, I'm going to make a provocative statement and say that the designer's role is actually to educate the full stack developer, which you're probably going to be working with. You're not going to necessarily have a very bespoke UI developer. You may have a full stack developer who's not very familiar with all the UI APIs. And I believe it's the designer's responsibility to guide the full stack developer on how to program the UI, not necessarily how to write a program, but what are the different parameters? What are the different configurations of the particular widget, right? Because the designer, if they don't understand that, they're now designing in abstract, delivering, and that's the engineer's responsibility to connect this drawing on a piece of paper with an actual API that they're forced to use because the company said, this is the APIs that you are using. Mm-hmm. So it's really incumbent upon the designer to really be very knowledgeable about the UI and front-end technology stack. And otherwise, he's just going to have to trust the engineer and only the engineer's assessment on the trade-offs between pushing back on design because it's too hard to implement versus building a robust user interface. I remember in the early days of my design career at Bloomberg, I was redesigning a chart application. I'd mentioned this before. And after a ton of customer research, I think I visited like on the order of 70 plus clients. It was just, we were discovering more and more and more. We couldn't stop until we found convergence. And it took a while. I designed a solution that was benefiting two groups of users, very different groups of users. And I found a solution that would benefit both. I was very happy to finally land on this design. I didn't have a UI person or a UI programmer to build it for me to test it. So I built it myself. Hey, I'm a computer scientist. I can do this. Put on my computer science hat. 2 weeks into this, I'm like, oh my God, this is so hard. This is so hard. I think I can change the design here. I think I can remove this specification there. I can take this shortcut there because I just need to get this build done. And it was like the aha moment was like there, right? Oh my gosh, here I am, a full-time designer being paid to do design, not being paid to write code. I'm going to put my engineering hat on for a few weeks and I've compromised the design. And I wasn't motivated to get the design perfect. I was motivated to get the implementation right because that's the hat I was wearing for those few weeks. So just think about an engineer who is an engineer for decades, not for a few weeks. That's their career. That's what they're paid to do. They're being measured by engineering metrics, not design metrics. They're absolutely not going to take the hard path to write the code, right? So you need to have an understanding of that technology to have good, challenging conversations with them to know truly what the trade-off is and to challenge that engineer. And they should challenge you in a similar fashion, right? They should have a good understanding of what makes good design, so that you can educate each other and get to a really good compromise.
That makes a ton of sense. And I think with that too, when you lean into those things, you raise the credibility of yourself and the credibility of your designs with the team. And you also have a really important, and you alluded to this, we'll use, it's like the sniff test, right? I don't necessarily need to be able to code it, but I need to know enough to be like, when they push back, to be able to like, really? Like to know what is hard and what's not and where they may be. We always called it the bullshit meter, which, you know, pardon the language, but like you just need enough to be like, nope, that's not passing the test. And I like, let's look at it again. So we're having good conversations. And I think that's an important, I mean, that's a trait we hear from product managers all the time as well, working with development. I can't do what you do, but I do want to make sure that we can have enough of a conversation that you know that I know where it is hard and where we have some flexibility.
Can I give one quick anecdote of,
absolutely.
I actually just thought of the story that I remember. It happened about 4 or 5 years ago. I won't say with who, but I remember asking an engineer to implement something. They came back with a 6-week estimate. Mm. And I could not understand it. Now, maybe my understanding of, I had been working on this system for probably 7 years. So I had a really, really good understanding of how things work there. Mm-hmm. And I just questioned it. And I said, can we at least try using it this way? It's very specific with the way. And I was conscious of the fact that I was asking an engineer to do something very specific about engineering. So it could have been taken in a bad way, but no, they understood where I was coming from. Like I really, really wanted to see if this could work. 2 minutes later, they called me and it was done.
Nice.
It was done in 2 minutes.
6 weeks.
Yeah, it was the fastest 6 weeks ever. Now, I'm not saying this is going to happen every time or even once a year, but it just goes to show you with the confidence you have in understanding the technology, there you're right. That BS meter you're referring to is going to be checked. Can be checked quite often. And it only puts you in an advantage and just makes it better for the user because you're going to get better designs out. It may require 1.5 times the effort, but that might be a good trade-off. You both agree that that's a good trade-off for the good for a better design.
But if it is 1.5 times the effort and you know it's just a small incremental betterment, you may not ask too, right? Exactly. I mean, there are times you check yourself where you're like, well, that would be cool, but that's like in the wouldn't it be neat if we could realm of not really, you know, probable. Certainly not for the benefit out there. So it's important that we can sort of filter those out.
Yeah. And not knowing and knowing what's not possible is also really good so that when you have to expand on the toolkit, maybe you need to extend the toolkit to do more and you can work, you may have to work with a different team. You may have to work with the toolkit team if that's a different team, right? So having that understanding is not just good for your relationship with the app developer, but also potentially that maybe there's that centralized set of toolkit developers that you may have to have a relationship as well with. It may be open source. You may have to do an investigation on your own and look and see what's coming out in the next version of the toolkit that is available through open source. So there's, I think it benefits you in many aspects, many different ways.
Yeah. I'd be interested in your perspective on this too. If you were talking to engineers and you were trying to give them advice on what they should think about to be a good partner to design, what kind of feedback might you give them?
Very good question. I think there's really, like, design is not magic, by the way. We always talk about demystifying design because it really is just about being disciplined. So if you can be disciplined, you can be a good designer. Maybe I wouldn't say that necessarily for like a visual design. You may have to be talented there too. But to be a good interaction designer or product designer, it's really about discipline. So I would encourage engineers to really learn the design process, whether it's the design thinking process or user-centered design process or the double diamond process, whatever design process, you know, floats your boat, to really truly understand that and to practice it, because it's really hard to do it the first time you see it because you're not going to be disciplined enough. Mm. So what it means to fail fast or learn fast. We now say learn fast. We don't say fail fast, right? We want to learn quickly or to experiment with really low fidelity, you know, prototyping. Those are all skills. Those are not things that just happen day one. So I would encourage engineering to kind of learn those basics, design 101 basics. You may not know all 743 cognitive biases of behavioral science day one, right? I'm not expecting you to know. I don't know them. I rely on our behavioral scientists with PhDs in psychology and sociology to keep me in check there, right? But when it comes to just the design process, it's very, very actually closely related to the engineering process. I'm sure engineers do the similar things with fast prototyping, failing fast, iterative development. And yeah, so it goes both ways.
Nice. All right. We covered a lot of different things today, Eddie. It's been fantastic. If you could get people listening to do 2 things differently tomorrow based on what we talked about today, what would they be?
Okay. 2 things. Well, number one, we talked about leadership. So I think there's something, if you could find something where your design team or your firm is yearning for leadership in that area, and it doesn't have to be design related, but something design related or like advancing the tooling of your team. You can be an individual contributor here, advancing the culture in some way, like organizing social gatherings after work. Could be firm-wide as well. Become a DEI or diversity, equity, and inclusion advocate, for example. Try to make a difference in some way, in that horizontal way, right? The non-traditional way where you're affecting a large number of people as an individual. Look for that, because there's probably other people who are yearning to go in the same direction. And you could be leading in that direction without necessarily having people under you. So that's number one. I would say look for those opportunities where people are yearning for leadership and be a leader. And then the second thing, I know it's so cliche to say, but it's empathy. Empathy, empathy, empathy. And we always talk about empathy for the users. I'm not going to talk about that. We didn't talk about that today. Empathy for your business. Go and learn about your business. At Bloomberg, we had this thing called Bloomberg University. It was great. You got to learn everything about every asset class, et cetera. JP Morgan, we have a similar set of, you know, resources. Your business probably will have ways for you to learn about the business. And don't be shy. Continue to learn. Try to find safe spaces to learn about the business. Empathize with your stakeholders, not just about the business, but about the person, why they get up in the morning, what makes them come to work, how they're getting rewarded at the end of the year. That's going to help you work with them so much better. And that includes your product stakeholder as well as your technology stakeholder. And on that note, like we just finished off, it's so important. Learn about the technology as well. And all of these things will just make you not just better design partners, but will make you potentially future leaders of designers for many years to come.
Awesome. All right, Eddie, it has been an absolute delight talking with you. Thank you for taking the time to share your story and your perspectives. And I hope you'll come on again sometime.
It was great to speak with you, Rebecca, and I'm glad to do it again.
All right. For all of those of you listening, if you'd like to learn more about these kind of conversations, how you can increase your impact in design, check out pragmaticinstitute.com/design. And thank you, everyone, for listening.